Hello!
Hey guys, it's Arden Cho.
This is Seth Gilliam.
Hey, this is Holland Roden.
My name is Kiahu Kuhuanui.
Hello, this is Ian Bowen.
Hey you guys, this is Melissa Ponzio.
I'm Lyndon Ashby.
Hey, it's Ronnie Adams.
This is Tyler Posey, and you are listening to Not Another.
Not Another.
Not Another.
This is Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
Yes, it is!
Oh.
Ha-ha!
This is Jeff Davis, and you're listening to Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast.
You gotta know, I'm feeling loved, made of gold. I never loved another one, another you. It's gotta be love, I said it. You gotta know, I'm feeling loved. You gotta know, I'm feeling loved.
Hello everyone, welcome to episode 76 of Not Another Teen Wolf Podcast. We're here this week to talk about episode 8 of season 4, Time of Death. Rather dramatic. If you want to get in touch with us about this episode or any of the other past ones that we've had, any interviews, any news, anything like that, you can reach us on our Twitter, which is NATW Podcast. You can reach us on our email address, which is natwpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can reach us on Tumblr, which is notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also leave comments on any of our Hyperbole articles about Teen Wolf or in the current post hosting this podcast on Hyperbole, and we'll see those and reply to them there as well. We always like to hear from anyone, especially if they have nice things to say, but feel free to hit us up with anything, really. We're always here to talk as your Teen Wolf therapists or whatever it is that we do. So usually it's me asking others about what they've been up to recently because I am stuck down in Australia where nothing ever happens. But this weekend was the one time, was the one weekend in a year that something Teen Wolf related happened in Australia, because I went to a Teen Wolf con this weekend, and so did Courtney, not in Australia. There were two different cons on, and we managed to be at both of them. Hers was in Houston, Texas, and mine was in Sydney, Australia. So I'm going to hand over to Karen to ask me about my experiences in the same way I usually morosely ask her about Comic-Con.
Yeah, this time I was the one that was sitting at home, and I was sort of like keeping one eye on each of you guys, and it was all crazy, and there was lots of stuff going on, but your con experience seemed pretty awesome. Who was there? We had Ian Bowen, Holland Roden, Max Carver, and Cinqua Walls, right?
Yeah, that's right. It was just a little one-day con, which is kind of the standard for Australia, unless there's kind of a once-a-year a big event, like Oz Comic Con is a big event, and then Supernova, which is a big event, not big, but like kind of, you know, like your Indie Pop Con or a bit bigger than that. But this was a Teen Wolf specific con, like Donya going to Wolfsbane or us going to BikeCon, but just a one-day event, which seems like a huge effort to bring people down just for a one-day event, but that's kind of how they ran it. They had a date in Melbourne that was one day, and then a date up in Sydney, which was one day. It was pretty good. Like, it had the structure of time, you know, was interesting. It was a little bit, it started quite early in the morning, and they had like all of the panels, and then they had like a big gap where they just sort of did all of the photo sessions and autographs, I suppose, which was good because it meant they didn't have anything overlapping. You didn't have to miss part of a panel to go to a photo session or something like that with another actor. But the timing was a bit like a little bit tiring, basically. But it was really fun. I mean, it was, yeah, the panels were really good. Really engaging. At first I was kind of going along being like, oh, I guess I should go along to this and do the live tweeting and stuff. It was a bit, you know, because I was going on my own, and that was sad. But they were really engaging once I got there, and I excessively live tweeted. It was very excited. And it had Ian and Holland. I've never met or seen them at a con before. They weren't at anything that I've been at before, and we didn't meet them on set either. And they were really cool. Their panels were really good. Cinco and Max did one together, and they were very... Anything Max Carver does is sure to be a hit, basically, because he is an incredibly ridiculous and engaging person. He's a great guest for cons, and Cinco was very funny as well. And then the other two, the two current cast members, had solo panels. And then at the end of Holland's, which was the last one of the day, Ian sort of came in the back and crashed it and started teasing her and asking silly questions in an Australian accent. And then all of the other three boys came down on stage, and they sort of did an impromptu panel with all four of them for about 15 minutes at the end of the day, which was nice. And yeah, it was really good. I don't know. It was fun. There were some really good sort of anecdotes. Ian especially, look, this is such a divisive thing, but so many people just don't want to hear anything from Ian Bowen except for, I hate my character and I hope he dies and that I get to stop being on Teen Wolf, because some people really don't like Peter, which is whatever. But I love hearing him talk about, like, sympathizing with his character in the same way I kind of like hearing Tom Hiddleston talk about his feelings about Loki, even though Loki is very much a not great character. Like, he obviously has his own motivations and stuff like that, but the person playing that character has to have some sort of sympathy, or has to have some, you know, backstory or empathy about the situation. And Ian Bowen has so much of that for Peter, and whether it's, you know, what we're seeing on screen or not, I don't know, but I really like hearing the way that he thinks about the character. It was really cool. My other favorite thing is that Holland Roden's dog apparently is best friends with a horse, and she's been traveling, and the dog is staying on this farm with a trainer, and the dog made best friends with a horse. And she goes into the stable and she sleeps on the horse every night, like curled up on the horse's back. And it's really weird.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I don't know. But I just randomly remembered that, but it was the most delightful thing I've ever heard. But no, she had she was really funny as well, especially when the guys came down. She was very sassing them quite a lot, like, and, you know, just really nice. And got to, say hi to everyone and get a little bit of an interview, which you might have heard on the podcast Tumblr, just a little bit of a 10-minute, interview, a few minutes with each of the people. Cinco I didn't get on tape, but he does want to come on the podcast sometime in future. There's a little thing for you. Yeah, at the end of there, he was just like, I really want to be a part of it. Come and please, like, hit up my agent. So, yeah, we might have something from Cinco for you in the future. But, yeah, it was really cool. It was really nice to see the two guys that I'd met before. They were very, you know, enthusiastic with their memories of BiteCon, which was nice. And it was really nice to meet the two people that I hadn't met, and everyone was just lovely, as, you know, would be expected. Like, no one disappointed me. I wasn't like, oh, you know, this guy's not very nice behind the scenes or anything. They were all very cool, so that was really fun. But Courtney also seemed to be having a fun time. She had Dylan Sprayberry at her con, and I think that might be his first con appearance, and he seemed very excited by that.
He was at San Diego Comic-Con.
Oh, well, that's different, isn't it? That's a bit, yeah. Like, yeah.
Houston, I guess the Houston con was fairly small, but in a good way, in one of those, like,
interactive
settings.
Yeah,
so that was probably a relief after San Diego, which is very big and very overwhelming.
And then there was Mason Dye there, who played Garrett. There was Orny Adams. There was Melissa Ponzio and Edie Mays. So Courtney had a nice time with all of those people. Some of them are familiar with the podcast and made a bit of a fuss of us being there in a good way, I think. And got to meet little Dill Spray. So that's fun, and hopefully we shall hear some more about that from her at some point. Oh, my con as well. Ian Bowen did the best impression of Orny Adams that I just... I wish someone had got it on tape. Like, you're not allowed to record the event, but oh my God, it was just... I just died. It was so good. That was fun. But yeah, everyone at the con seemed really nice, like all of the audience. very pro Lydia Parrish. Every time that people were talking about, like, you know, shipping or anything like that, and Lydia, you know, people would just be shouting, "What about Parrish?" Like, they really like the idea of Lydia and Parrish, which, I mean, I don't mind that idea either. So, yeah, but that was nice, and yeah, it was all good. And hopefully, there'll be more Teen Wolf events in Australia in the future. Karen.
Yeah.
I'm here. I'm finished my sentence. We can start.
Okay. I just didn't know.
No.
Shall we move on to the quotes?
Yes, I suppose so. Yeah, so for my quote this week, I picked one that happened pretty much right off the bat in the episode in terms of the scene where the group is kind of planning to kill Scott or whatever it is that they're doing, where we see Nachiko getting involved to help supervise and instruct in the procedure. You know, she's kind of being very blunt about not having actually done this before and all that kind of thing. And Kira says, "Mom, you're not inspiring confidence." And Nachiko just goes, "Good. This is a terrible idea." And I think I love her. Like, I feel like if I have a single person in all of Teen Wolf that I relate to the most, if people are going to say, "Oh, you're the..." If I did a quiz, like, which character in Beacon Hills are you, I might end up getting Nachiko, because she's just very blunt and, like, I don't know, I just like her a lot. And I really empathized with her at that moment, basically, because, yeah, it's horrible. And it's just, I really like seeing the parents getting involved, but this was a terrible idea. I mean, not that they had a better option. I mean, they could have just not done it, but yeah, I loved that she didn't sugarcoat that.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I love her as a character is she's very strict, way more strict than Kira's dad is. He's kind of chill, and I mean, he can get that way a little bit, but it's definitely her mom that's sort of like, you know, the head of the household, and yet it never comes off as something that's really annoying or abrasive or like, oh, we don't like her because she's so mean and strict. It's like you can tell how much she cares about her daughter, and she just kind of lays it out on the line, but it always comes from like a good place in her heart, and I really like that about her.
Yeah, I do as well. I just think that, yeah, I think, I mean, after 900 years or whatever, you kind of lose patience with pointless niceties, I guess. Like, that might, you know, be a thing that happened if you'd been around for 900 years. But I always very much enjoy her, and she is kind of, as you said, she's kind of strict, but, you know, it isn't irrational, and it isn't, like,
yeah,
in an antagonistic way, and that's cool to me. How about you, Karen?
Well, mine was from Brayden to Derek when she was teaching him how to pull a gun on her, and she kept taking it away, and she goes, "I can do this all day," and it was just, we're going to talk about this scene in depth, guaranteed, later on, so that's all I'll say for now, but great line, great scene.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts.
Well, let's jump right into the episode then, because the first thing that we see is how Stiles became the little spoon. And I really, really liked this scene. I thought it was funny, and I thought it was great how it wasn't just like Malia sort of taking over and being like, obviously I'm the big spoon, when they were, you know, sleeping in the same bed together. But they kind of had to like figure each other out and figure out how they were going to sleep in the same bed. And they did, and Stiles became the little spoon, and he was really comfortable with it, and it was so nice.
Yeah, I mean, this is presumably like a memory, just him being sad that she's not there anymore, obviously, but it was cute. And yeah, I mean, he kind of played it off when he was talking to Scott, like it was like a, you know, problem, when he was like, "I'm always the little spoon," but like seeing the reality of the situation was really nice, and like seeing that kind of, you know, how, like, I don't know if they slept there, you know, together like that every night or whatever, like if she just went, you know, over there and climbed in the window every single night or whatever. But it was really nice. And I don't know, it just reminded me a lot of, It weirdly reminded me a lot of my own high school relationships. I had some relatively unusual high school relationships as well, where that were a bit more like Styles and Malia and a bit less like the kind of awkward dating, if you know what I mean, and like a lot of kind of like sleepovery, staying with each other's family for a long period of time, you know, not, I don't know whether the sheriff really knows about this or not, but like just much more like kind of that sort of quote unquote part of the family kind of closeness. And it really reminded me of that, and not that they all ended that well or anything, but I don't know, it just again sort of hammered home the difference in the Styles and Malia relationship to a lot of the other relationships in the show. And I don't know, I would really like to just sit down in a room with them, not that they exist or anything, but like I really am fascinated by the dynamic. I mean, and you know, hopefully that gets back on track at some point, but like why that's what they're doing, if you know what I mean. It's not like, you know, Kira and Scott both have super stealth as well, but it's not like they're sneaking to each other's bedrooms at night. And it's not just, you know, it's also not like, oh, they're sneaking around to have sex. I mean, whether or not they are having sex is not all that clear at the moment. And I think that's something that people are somewhat, you know, conversational about. But it didn't seem, you know, it doesn't seem like that. It doesn't seem like, you know, Scott jumping out the window after making out with Allison, if you know what I mean. It seems just a bit more like,
yeah.
You know, it seems like two people who are sort of trying to have a home together, if you know what I mean. And it's really different, and it does remind me a lot of some of my high school relationships, which were very unusual in terms of the dynamic compared to usual teen relationships, apparently, I guess. And yeah, I don't know, I liked it. It was sad and it was cute, but yeah.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It was sad and it was cute, but yeah, I liked it. And, you know, another relationship that is sort of still developing is the one between Scott and his father. And we see sort of the repercussions of him shooting the chemist in the head in front of Styles. And he sort of does like his little report on a recorder, and he tells Scott that he has to leave for a little while, go back to the office and, like, you know, do a report and follow up and kind of take care of business. But when he gets back, he wants to know everything. And that's kind of frightening.
Yeah. I've got a few thoughts about this. Firstly, about what he knows, like if he knows about stuff, but that he knows that Scott, etc., haven't told him, if you know what I mean. Like, if he separately knows and,
right,
you know. My other question is whether his conversation with Scott about, you know, Scott's very curious about, you know, how, you know, his dad has handled having to, you know, kill someone in the line of service. And do you think that that's, like, foreshadowing for Scott to be able to handle that, doing that himself?
It's definitely something that I wonder about, because I mean, it's obvious that they're sort of hinting at that. Whether that's kind of like a red herring or not, I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I remember Jeff saying something along the lines of, you know, we can't have Scott like kill somebody. He's our hero, he's supposed to stay very pure. I mean, whether or not that vision has changed, I don't know. But I don't want Scott to kill anybody. But if it comes down between him saving, you know, like Kira's life or Styles's life and having to kill a bad guy, then I think that it's something that, you know, could be lived with, both for Scott and for us.
I mean, we've seen plenty of people on the show kill people or demons and stuff without them being bad people, if you know what I mean. Like, we've seen, Chris Argent and even people like Brayden, and I'm sure Derek, you know, who knows how many people Derek has killed in fights since he has been an adult or whatever. He killed Peter, I guess, like, sort of. I mean, he attempted it anyway. And, you know, in a high stakes circumstance and violent world, you know, you kind of get to the point where you have to question like whether killing people makes you a bad person. You compare it to like Buffy, for example. You know, she kills heaps of demons and challenging, you know, supernatural beings. Because we're not just talking about Scott killing a human. Like, it's not like he's going out and killing a random human. We'd probably be talking about him killing another supernatural being. But in this world, supernatural beings are just as human as anyone else. It's not like in Buffy where it's like, oh, you're part demon, you're valid for me to kill. But, oh, you're full human, I can't kill you even though you're super evil, if you know what I mean. Like,
yeah.
But, you know, so it's not quite the same. Like, you know, she had a big, you know, Buffy had this big drama where she... she thought she accidentally killed a person. It was actually them brain sort of duping her. She didn't do it. But, you know, killing an actual person was a no-go zone, but she killed heaps and heaps and heaps of demons and supernatural things. But in this world, that line of being a person and being supernatural is a bit more close. Like, it's not really...
Mm-hmm.
That definition isn't there. So... whether he'd be killing like a human assassin or another supernatural or another werewolf or whatever, you know, question whether it would actually make him a bad person or if it's just sort of what comes in the line of duty. But yeah, the conversation with his father really seemed like, you know, foreshadowing or at least setting up of that, you know, being a possibility or even Scott himself thinking, you know, oh, well, he's done this, you know, does that make him a bad person? Like, how does he cope with it? Will I have to do that? It at least made me think that Scott was questioning it himself.
Yeah, and I mean, Scott's been sort of towing that line this episode, or this season, especially when we see him kind of debating whether or not he should take the money. I mean, that is... illegal to steal that money. And of course, Derek is his friend, so why wouldn't he give the money back to Derek? And I think a lot of this season, you know, we knew this season was going to focus on the human side of things, and I think this is just another facet of that, because what line are you willing to cross in order to keep people safe, in order to keep the entire town safe? And I think Scott's been dealing with that for quite some time, and it's finally just coming to a head. So I'm definitely curious to see what direction they end up taking this in.
Yeah, I mean, obviously McCall is going to be leaving, I guess, for a while, and I don't know if we'll see him again at the end of the season. Like, if this is just a bye-bye, you're out of here now situation. It does seem like it's a pretty pretty rough circumstance for him to be in, and I feel pretty bad for him, you know, even giving that report, you know, into the tape recorder at the beginning. I felt kind of like, oh, this clearly sucks for you, but I don't know, we'll see, I guess, if that's going to come back, or, you know, if Scott will be learning any more life lessons from his dad about, you know, killing people.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I'm really curious if he's going to be coming back too. I mean, we're not that close to the end of the season. This was episode 8. There are 12 episodes, so we still have a few more left. We're a little over halfway. And I mean, the big part of this episode's storyline is that Scott McCall dies, quote unquote, and he is pronounced dead in the hospital, and he's actually dead for 45 minutes on the record. I mean, we know that he's still sort of alive, but he's in this sort of comatose state. And I have to wonder what kind of serious consequences this is going to have, because for one, the doctor pronounced him dead, and that's kind of a hard mistake to make, you know what I mean? I mean, he looked dead and he was flatlining. And also in terms of his dad, who had just left, you know, he's obviously going to be hearing about this. What's that going to mean for him? What's that going to mean for the doctor? What's that going to mean for basically everybody, but especially Scott?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of things in this town have happened that are not particularly well explained. Like, for example, Styles killing everyone in the hospital and apparently being able to like walk around town like he's not like a murderer, basically. So I mean, you know, not, we know that it's not Styles' fault, but like, you know, Scott, I mean, who knows? Like, I don't know. My theory is that everyone in the town knows exactly what's going on, but they don't like to spoil the, you know, idea that the kids are keeping this big secret. And so it's like, don't tell them that we know, if you know what I mean. Like, everyone knows, like, oh, just Scott, he's up to his werewolf tricks again. He's doing so well to try and keep it a secret, you know. Don't let on that we know. Let him think that he's being really clever or something. No, of course that's just nonsense. But I don't know. I mean, seeing that, you know, Melissa reaction and everything like that, and seeing he's in the morgue, like he's in the freezer. Like I don't, like, what would happen if a person really was in like a coma or something and then came back to life and they were in a morgue freezer? Like, God, like. Like, they should have, yeah, I mean, yeah, they definitely didn't really have an answer for, you know, how that happened. All they said was, you know, he has to go back and get some tests and stuff like that. So, I don't know, Karen.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how they explain it.
Mm.
Another big storyline this episode was Derek turning human, more human than he has been, and the beginning part of that is that we find out he can no longer even, like, change his eyes. He can't make them glow gold anymore. And this is, I mean, I knew that this was happening. I knew that he was losing his ability to heal. He wasn't quite as strong. He was becoming more human. But to me, this was like final confirmation that this is a really big deal and that it's really happening. And it's a little scary.
Yeah, I don't care. I will take him human and powerless in exchange for his incredible and amazing personality. I do not care about him turning human. I just want him to stay this funny.
Yes. I think all of us on the podcast do. We're still having conversations about this. Like, as we're recording, the girls are going crazy in the group, and it's just, it's really great. But we'll leave that conversation for a little bit, because there's definitely a lot to talk about there. But I want to go back to what's happening in the hospital. And basically, Melissa Ponzio is incredible. The way that she reacted as Melissa, Scott's mother, the way she reacted to Scott's death was, I can't even describe it, like, so realistic and so frightening and so heartbreaking. And we know that that was an act, that Melissa was in on it, thank God, because if she hadn't been, that would have just traumatized her. But major props to Melissa Ponzio.
I didn't see the trailer, but I don't know if they showed this or not. Did you know when watching the episode, like, until, you know, she goes through to the morgue and joins the group, did you know she was in on it?
No.
I kind of suspected. Like, I honestly, her reaction to me seemed, I don't know, I just had a feeling that it was being put on, but I wasn't sure, like, not until she walked into the group, if you know what I mean, like, and then was like, she was like, I really hate this plan, like, yeah. But it was pretty intense, and, like, that's the thing, like, seeing her have that breakdown, like, you know, that, you know, the doctor, you know, Liam's stepfather and all of that kind of stuff, they seem, you know, everyone saw her go through that. Like, it's just gonna be so weird that Scott isn't dead, if you know what I mean. What about that time they put Jackson in a body bag? Like, does this just happen a lot in Beacon Hills? Like, that people are dead and then they're just not dead anymore? Like, I just...
Yeah.
That's like, oh, okay, yeah. They must have some, yeah, very sort of lenient, you know, coroners and stuff like that. Like...
They need to, like, check their machines and see if they're broken or not. Like, I swear he didn't have a heartbeat for 45 minutes. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely something that I think maybe suspend your disbelief a little bit, but I have a feeling, I mean, Teen Wolf has been so on point with us having being like, okay, we need an explanation for this, and basically the next episode giving it to us. So I think hopefully next episode we'll see a little bit of that coming through and being like, okay, yeah, Scott was pronounced dead. Yeah, people are wondering. And they kind of bring it up, I think it was near the end of the episode too, about Liam's father, who was the doctor that pronounced him dead, and him having a lot of questions. So I wonder if that's going to be an open door for Liam to tell his father, his stepfather, about him being a werewolf maybe, and kind of cluing him in on the situation.
Yeah, that's true, actually. You'd hope so at some point. Poor Liam.
He went through a lot in this episode.
Oh, little
emotionally.
Liam. Little Liam. Little tiny werewolf. He's so so worried and sweet. Like, we're basically, and we see the actual flashback to the scene in the house where they basically, I guess, some process that I guess a thunder kitsune, like someone who has the power of like lightning and electricity, can do, which is to give someone supernatural like a special shock to the heart, which will mean they will be sort of slowed down. It's just like in, you know, Captain America 2, Karen, where Nick Fury has some of that special potion that slows his heartbeat to like one beat a minute to fake his death.
Yeah.
Except not like that.
except Kira did it.
Yeah.
Kira, I mean, the fact that Kira was the one that quote unquote killed him, like, that was really intense, and I didn't want to watch it. And Brooke, who I will blame everything on for forever, was like, yeah, I have it in my head that Styles wasn't in the room because he couldn't watch. Like, he had to leave, which completely broke my heart.
Yeah.
And it's now what I'm thinking happened as well.
I also think that they definitely didn't tell Derek about this plan, because Derek would have outright forbid it. He would have been like, you're not freaking doing that. Like, no. He would have just been like, no, you can't kill Scott. Like, he would have just been like, this is not going to happen. I am going to refuse. And he would have, like, laid across Scott's chest and not let Kira do it. Like, seriously. I think they had to probably avoid telling Derek, and I want to like have the repercussion of Derek yelling at them all about this. It's really important to me.
Oh my god. Okay, this just popped into my head. I want like a Pocahontas Derek Hale crossover where he's Pocahontas and he lays across Scott, who is John Smith, and then Kira is the father, you know, because he's gonna kill John
yes.
Smith. Need artwork of this.
Oh my god.
It would be beautiful. Somebody do it, please.
Oh my god. Yeah. But yeah. So yeah, Styles in there, but Liam, baby Liam, oh my god, he also loves Scott so much. Guys, everyone loves
yes.
Scott so much. Everyone really loves Scott.
Yes, they should.
But like, oh my god, Liam, he's so like, and everyone's always like, Liam, run away. You're too tiny. And because he's a werewolf. He's got, like, you know, weapons and stuff in his body. But, yeah, but people are very protective of Liam, like the rest of the group. Probably because he's been a werewolf for about 14 minutes and doesn't really have to do with anything. But, oh, he's so tiny and cute and so concerned. And I really do think that his bond with Scott is quite instinctual. Like, I feel like that's something that they're actually doing really well, as opposed to, you know, it's not forced or anything like that. It's not like Scott's forcing him to have any control, but I feel like that the alpha bond might be one that is quite, like, you know, really instinctually being around them makes you feel better, or you have very heightened concern for them and stuff like that. Like, I think that that's something that's more than just a personality choice, and I think they're doing a really good job with showing Liam's dependence on Scott like that, and it's so cute.
Yeah. I really want to bring up, too, because I think it's instinctual as well, but like you said, it's not forced, because if you think back to season one and the way in which Peter was able to control Scott,
yeah.
But Scott kept resisting. He didn't, I mean, Peter had to force Scott to do stuff. And
yeah.
I think that while Liam's Liam is instinctually sort of connected to Scott. He's also watching Scott and seeing the kind of person that he is, and he really takes to that as well. So I definitely want to point out that, yeah, it's not being forced. Like, Liam actually genuinely, I think, cares about Scott.
Oh, yes, yes. But it seems a bit more than a normal sort of human bond by friendship.
If you yeah, know. And he it took seems... to it. Very quickly.
It seems like there's something there that's not just, oh, two people that know each other and care about each other. It seems like there's something quite sort of more than that going on. And I think they're doing quite a good job of showing that, actually.
Yeah. And something else that I keep bringing up on the podcast is that we've gotten characters who normally don't interact.
Yeah.
Interacting and
Styles
in this,
and Chris,
Styles and Chris, and it was great. I mean, this is kind of sad because they're trying to contact the benefactor to tell him about Scott's death. And but I mean, Styles, Dylan O'Brien makes it so funny in a way that doesn't seem cheap or like you're laughing at something that's horrific and makes you feel like a terrible person. But you know, they're really trying to figure out how to bring the benefactor out of hiding, and the way that they interact with each other was just gold.
It was great, and they keep doing it, and they keep said like new, you know, pairings, new people who have scenes together, and like there is no one on this show that doesn't have good chemistry. Like, there's no one that's fallen flat, if you know what I mean. Even, like, later you see, like, Melissa and Nishiko just by themselves together. And
oh,
that's
my God.
So
that
good.
Like
so
one of my
good.
Highlights.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, they everyone's just really, really good at working with each other. And it's really cool. So, I don't know. I really enjoyed that. I thought that it was really, really good.
Yeah, I mean, not that this kind of falls under that same category just because Scott and Liam obviously are together a lot, but I liked seeing their interactions a lot this episode, and a lot of it came through Scott's dreams, which progressively got darker and darker. I mean, Liam keeps dying, the mute comes back, and he's killing Liam, and by the end of the sequence of dreams, Scott is actually the one who kills Liam. And to me, that was, you know, there's a lot of metaphor in there about him being worried about becoming a monster and not being able to protect Liam from himself. And I think the dreams were really well done because they were set up very similarly, but they kept changing little elements of it until you got to the end when Scott is the one that ends up killing Liam.
Yeah, it was quite strange. But yeah, I liked kind of the repetitiveness of it, and I liked the strangeness of it, basically. Even the way that it was all put together, you know, like, you know, shot and edited and whatever, it was very different to what we usually see on Team Wolf, and different to any sort of slightly non-this world sequences that we've seen, like in, you know, hallucinations or anything like that. We've seen our fair share of hallucinations or being inside someone's head and something like that. This was different yet again from that, like, so
yeah,
it was quite interesting. But yeah, I mean, you see that you know he is evolving, like with more teeth and like stuff, like that
which is very interesting.
And, yeah, because he was looking in the mirror and I was like, I swear his teeth didn't used to look like that. And then he said, I kind of thought it and I'm like, hang on, is this a thing? And then he actually said the line and I'm like, yeah, this is meant to be a thing.
And it wasn't just the dream sequence. He said, yeah, I noticed this after, like, when he was being quarantined.
Yeah. And I mean, that we may see more in terms of, there seems to be a lot of themes this season of, you know, power changing and things like that. Obviously Derek, you know, is having the opposite, and Peter is whatever Peter is doing. And then but Scott, we may see, you know, adapting either into a, you know, a different wolf shape. That was something that actually Ian Bowen mentioned at the convention, was talking about like the different alphas that have chosen to take a full wolf shape or you know, some monster shape or something like that, and why that's happened, and just basically what it means, like, to have your form changing, I guess, what that would mean for you.
Yeah, that's probably the direction in which they're going. I mean, logically, that makes the most sense to me. But I kept thinking about Ennis, because Ennis had those double canines, and the entire Alpha Pack sort of had their own little, like, specialities. And when I first saw this, I was wondering if, like, maybe Scott was just developing his own or something like that. But I think it makes much more sense if he's evolving, I guess, is the best way to put it, into maybe something else.
You're thinking about Pokemon, aren't you?
I am.
I can tell. But yeah, I don't know. The dream was, yeah, I kind of felt like it. I didn't quite expect it to get to the point where he started killing Liam. What I did expect was that he was going to be doing killing in the dream sequence. I thought he might turn around and kill Lemute. And so it would be like he would know, at least in the dream, how it felt to kill someone. I didn't expect it to go to sort of the darkness of, you know, him, of the mute convincing him to kill Liam. And I don't know if that's just meant to be a projection of fears and stuff like that. But, you know, they are really hammering home this idea of him, you know, being worried with having to face this.
Yeah, I mean, that was my interpretation, that he was afraid of becoming the monster, that he was afraid he was going to be the reason why he lost Liam. I mean, not so much that he's the one physically doing the killing, but that it would be his fault. But I want to talk about the mute coming back, because...
Yeah, and the alternate list as well, like with Scott's name.
That was interesting. But I'm a little disappointed, I'm not going to lie, that the mute came back in a dream sequence. I really wanted to see him back in real life.
He's dead. Just because you can't see him in real life.
I know. Well, you know what I mean. But I was disappointed. And I mean, I guess it makes a lot more sense logically to do it this way. But the Mew is somebody that is so interesting to me, and we hardly know anything about him. And I wanted to learn more, and we didn't. But that's just me.
I'm sorry about that. What did you think of the alternate list? Is that just meant to be like people Scott had to kill? Like, I didn't really understand what the significance of that alternate list was.
Well, the thing is, they're all dead, because the chemists are there, the orphans and the mute. So I think that maybe he was like thinking about how... Well, he didn't kill them, though. That's the thing. I thought it was maybe like a projection of guilt or something, but he didn't kill any of them.
Oh, God. Maybe he's going to be able to find, like, a list of, like, I don't know, like, the people that the benefactor list has been...
The assassins?
Distributed to, you know, or something like that. But I don't... I was confused by that. I'm not going to lie. I was flat out confused by that.
Yeah. Maybe it'll kind of come back, because Scott's name was the cipher code, so I don't know. We'll have to see.
Actually, that's interesting, because that was actually one of the things that in my little snippet with Max, even, because I asked him about what he thought about Aiden's name being one of the ciphers, and he was like, I kind of liked it, you know, that he's still, you know, remembered in some way and blah, blah. But he was also like, I also don't think that you've seen the end of things with, like, names coming, like, with basically with ciphers and with names coming on the list. And I was like, what you talking about, boy? Because, like, Alyssa had said, you know, oh, God, we can't do more lists and stuff like that. But then, lo and behold, this episode, here's more lists and ciphers, even if it's in the dream sequence. So, yeah, I guess that he has been keeping up to date behind the scenes with what's going on.
Yeah. I like the idea that maybe Scott will find a list of the assassins. And, well, I mean, we've even seen clips from future episodes. I think it might have been in the mid-season trailer where Derek says, you know, if they're going to put us on a list, let's put them on a list and make our own Deadpool and make sure that nobody else stops. We go after them. So maybe that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like if they start knowing who's coming and sort of going after them first. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think Scott would, again, to throw back to Captain America 2, because apparently that has a reference for all things at the moment, that's kind of like, do you think Scott would actually take that move, because that's very like Project Insight. Like that's kind of what Hydra was attempting to do, which was to kill off threats before the threats made right. their move, if you know what I mean. And do you think that if Scott had a list of people who he knew were coming after them, that he'd make the aggressive move rather than just defensive?
I mean, oh, that's so hard, because on the one hand, I want to say no, because Scott doesn't believe in that sort of thing. He's not that he's passive, but that he doesn't want to hurt other people. But at the same time, if these people are planning on killing him and his friends and his family, then what else can you do about it, you know? So once again, very much moral gray area that Scott has to navigate. And I'm really interested to see where they're going to take him, because either way, I can't really blame him. I can't blame him for not wanting to kill people. And I can't blame him if he does kill people who are trying to kill him.
Yeah. Yeah.
But let's talk about somebody who apparently is not in the moral gray area. And that's Peter, who basically, I mean, him and Malia come face to face finally. I'm really glad this has finally happened. I've been looking forward to this. And he tells Malia that, yeah, he's crazy, and yeah, he's killed people, but so have a lot of other people, which, okay, fair enough. But Malia finds a file with her name on it, and Peter actually lets her read it. What did you think of their interactions?
I was somewhat surprised that Malia, like, it actually went better than I expected, in terms of, I was a bit worried that they'd have Malia running to him and being, like open to his point of view, if you know what I mean, like, that she would be less of a good person about it, but she actually doesn't seem super interested in him, even though I guess, it's never said between them, but I guess she knows that he's the dad. But she doesn't really seem to have much time for him. Like, I thought it would be like, oh my God, I know that you're my dad, so now, and they've all lied to me, so you're the only one I can trust, and I'm going to come and be manipulated by you, if you know what I mean. I thought it would be like that, but it actually was less like that than I expected.
She's very suspicious of him still.
She doesn't really have the time for him. She's curious about the mother, which is interesting. But she does not seem to be too fond of him, even though she knows he's the dad, which was, you know, impressive, I guess. Yeah, I was basically pretty keen on that Peter backstory that, you know, like, that's, you know, one of the thing that Ian said at the panel that I just saw as well, was that, like, Peter is like a nightmare train wreck circumstance of himself. Like, this current Peter now, after the fire, is like a mental snapping point, nightmare, train wreck version of that human being. Or, you know, and what he said about being in that coma, totally cognitive for 6 years and just driving himself insane in his own brain, to me makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's not exactly a sympathetic thing, but
right.
But it's interesting to me. I really like the idea of it being that kind of like psychotic break, though some of the actions that we see of Peter, even before the fire, like flashback young Peter, are pretty messed up. So I don't really know what kind of person he was before. Ian seems very convinced that he was a much better person before, and that the fire was really made him crazy. But
which I think is fair.
It's fair as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's always been manipulative, but he wasn't quite at the level that he is now. So I think the fire did change him a lot, even if he wasn't the best person to begin with.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff with the flashback, like, still really confusing to me, like, what his aim was in that whole page situation. And
yeah.
It was really, like, he was a bitter little kid, whoever he was. I don't know what was going on, and I wouldn't be surprised to find out if he was, you know, nasty then as well. But Ian's impression really seems to be that he was decent and that he'd be very different now if it wasn't, you know, for the fire. But I was mainly, as I said, just quite surprised that it wasn't, like, Malia running to him, if you know what I mean. Like, and he seems pretty keen on her. Like, he seems pretty keen on making an ally of her, or at least, you know, doing right by her, which is nice. I don't really know what his aim is. Oh, by the way, if you guys didn't see this on Twitter, this was actually probably my favorite thing of the whole day, just tying into the Malia and Peter situation. Someone asked what Peter would think if he finds out that, like, Malia, his daughter, is, you know, going out with Styles or doing whatever she's doing with Styles. And he said, ironically, probably Styles is the one person that he would trust Malia with, and that he, like, Peter, not Ian, like, loves and respects Styles. Like, he absolutely thinks Styles is the bomb, basically. And he knows that Styles hates him, but he loves Styles. And I have always thought that. Like, I've always thought that Peter had, a lot of respect for Styles, and that, you know, no matter how much Styles ends up, you know, hating Peter, I think that Peter is one of Styles' biggest fans, basically, and I loved that, you know, not that he's going out of his way to try and make Styles an ally or manipulate him or anything like that, but I found it interesting that he would like the idea of Malia being with Styles, basically. But again, like, that sort of, it seemed to imply that he has some care about her as his daughter, like, more than just, what can I get out of this situation? So, I mean, how did you kind of take his treatment of her and, like, the way that he talked to her and what he seems to think about her at the moment?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I think that he cares about her, at least from afar. I think that when you have a child, no matter, you know, how manipulative you are, you do have some sort of empathy for your own kid. So I think there's a little part of him that really does care about Malia. At the same time, I think everything he's doing, as is everything he always does, is very calculating. And at the moment, Malia is the new girl. She knows about Peter, but she never went through what everyone else went through. So if Peter is able to sort of mold somebody and manipulate them, it's going to be her. I mean, Kira is the same way, but obviously Peter doesn't have the same sort of connection with Kira as he does with Malia. So I think that he is probably going to try to use her to his advantage, which is really, really sad. But like you said, she does not have time for him. And I love that, because this entire season has, I mean, everybody was really suspicious of Malia at the end of season 3, and in season 4, they've done a fantastic job of making us like her. I mean, some people still hold their grudges or whatever, which is fine, that's something else, but I think Malia as a character is really interesting and really well written, and for them to sort of all of a sudden turn her around and be in Peter's pocket would have been really, really disappointing. So I'm glad they didn't go in that direction.
Yeah, I agree.
So something I want to know about is when we go to the next scene, you know, one of the cameras in the hospital goes down and the kids notice it because they sort of hijacked the system. And Kira decides to go check it out to see if the benefactor is around. And Liam sort of runs after her. And I just have to know if you think Liam still has this, like, crush on Kira. Because I kind of hope so. I think it's really cute.
I didn't really think about it. But when he was like, I'm coming too, like, I didn't even think about it in that aspect. But no, I totally bet that is what it is. Which is kind of like, surely if he does have, like, an alpha beta bond with Scott, surely he should be, like, instinctually warned off Kira. But it was, I totally questioned, like, why was he so keen to run after him? I loved Styles being like, kids, you come right back here, if you know what I mean. Like, he was so so good. But I think that he possibly could still have a crush on Kira. Either that or he just wanted to help in some way, if you know
protect
what I mean.
Her. But, yeah, which could be an instinctual thing too. But I kind of see it as this, like, funny little, like, puppy crush, and it's not, like, it doesn't mean anything. It's sort of somebody to just, like, pine after and in your own head kind of crush on. I don't think, like, he actually has feelings for her in the same way that Scott has feelings for her, but I think it's cute if he just kind of, like, trails after her and wants to protect her, and maybe that's on behalf of Scott, who knows, but I just thought it was a funny little scene.
Yeah, I just like the Styles. I focused on mainly the Styles dad bit, but
yes,
but yeah, I didn't just think about the crush, but yeah, totally.
All right, so let's talk about this Derek scene, because we're just freaking out about it.
There were so many Derek scenes, even the first one where she comes over and he catches her hands, and she was all like, show me your eyes, and he was just like, you just saw them. And like,
he like rolled over and like...
Such a little brat. I love
like,
him.
Angry cat. My cat does that. Like, she'll get mad at me and she'll go to the edge of the bed and she'll just plop down with her butt towards me like, this is all you're getting. And that's exactly what Derek did.
Oh my god. I feel like I should just like recite some of the like texts that we've been sending or something, because they're just, guys, it's just so important. He is so funny and chill and just, I just love him. And I don't know if it's just because we've had so much, like, hardcore angst and him only saying really strained things, but, and I don't know if it's just that he's, like, become human, so he's just stopped caring, if you know what I mean, or if it's, like, just because time has passed and he has actually become more relaxed and stuff like that, but oh my god, he's so good. Like, it's just the slight lighthearted tone in his voice, like, like, the lack of total angst in his voice is just doing wonders. And it's just, it just allows his, like, sarcasm and, like, sweetness and just grumpy brattiness to shine through. And I just love him. Karen, would you like to say some words?
Oh, my gosh. It's so hard to articulate how good this scene was, because... the Derek that we've seen since season one has been, his face has always sort of been very blank, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Like,
it's not a wooden acting thing. It's not.
Very,
it was like a, yeah, and it was like a, yeah, it was like a blocking out thing, and his eyebrows were always very angry, and and it's just,
but now he's so expressive in a lot of really subtle ways, and his personality is finally showing through. I mean, he's finally come to the conclusion that power is not everything, and he has decided that his job now, his goal in life, is to help Scott and for Scott to become the alpha, the leader, the protector of Beacon Hills. And Derek is going to be there to help him. And that conclusion has changed everything for him. And I mean, let's not look at, you know, the main point here, which is that Derek is becoming human. And for somebody who was a born werewolf, he doesn't know how to be human. And
oh my God,
he
does. So good.
It's so good. He doesn't understand that, you know, oh, he has a wound. He has to cover it up so it doesn't get infected. He just doesn't get it. And the fact that he is so willing to learn, especially from Brayden, who, I mean, Brayden is so kick-ass. I love her so much. But she's a mercenary, and she's sort of been on opposite sides of Derek in the past. I mean, they're obviously closer now, but he's so willing to learn from her and to be like, okay, so I can't use my claws and my teeth anymore. I need to learn how to use a gun. And he's willing
Derek
to do that.
Is the ultimate Ravenclaw. He is so, he's just been caught up in a lot of angst for the past short while since Laura died. You know, it's been a year or whatever. But Derek, we see him, you know, you were saying the other week about how he's always been smart. He knows everything. He's clearly cherished learning for a long time. And he is just like a sponge for information, if you know what I mean. And it's awesome. Like, he's not, you know, he's not like, leave me alone, you can't tell me what to do, if you know what I mean. He is really honest with himself, and that's a really good thing. And he's really honest with himself. He's really, like, willing to take things on board. He's not like, oh, I know best, if you know what I mean. He's no longer hopped up on alpha juice, obviously, as we know. and he's just... I don't know, he's just so good. And it's what's really interesting to me is, like, it's not like I think, oh, the writers stole this idea from the fandom for what his personality is like. But I think that even the small snippets that you saw of what he could be in earlier seasons, the small, you know, moments you saw him kind of either react to something, you know, funny or sarcastic or whatever, it sort of painted a picture pretty quickly of what his personality would be like if he chilled the hell out. And that this is it. Like, and people have been writing fan fiction with very similar kind of personality before now. Actually, people actually often write him less expressive than this. Like, this is more expressive than people expected him to ever be. Except I think
it's
it is
so good.
I think it is, like, it doesn't feel like, oh my god, what have they done? This is totally alien and weird, if you know what I mean. It is fitting. It is him. Like, I could watch season one and tell you this about him. You know, and how what he was doing then was, like, posturing, and it was defense mechanism, if you know what I mean. Like, and it was that kind of thing. And but this is just, it's so good. And I don't have proper words to describe how good it is, Karen, but it's so good.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's like, I wish, I mean, if you see the episode and you have any sort of connection to Derek, you're going to know, like, what we're trying to say. So I feel like it's okay to not really be able to express it properly because people are going to get it. It's just a really well-written scene.
That gun scene, I only had time to watch this whole episode once before recording this because I just came home from work, watched the episode, and then we recorded. But I rewound and I just watched that gun scene again after the episode finished. I felt the need to immediately go. And that doesn't happen that often to me. Sometimes I rewatch the whole episode later, but I don't usually rewind to just go to one scene, but I did that for this. So, yeah.
I've only seen it once, and I really, really, especially now talking about it, I really need to go back and watch it again because I really liked when Derek kisses Brayden and, you know, he cheats and he bends the rules and then they end up, like, sleeping together or something, but, like, it was just, I like that, and I think Courtney may have brought this up, one of the girls brought this up, he made the move, and it was his decision, and, you know, because he has gotten very manipulated by women in the past, Kate and Jennifer in particular, and it was nice for him to be the one to make the move, and to sort of consciously be like, okay, I trust you, this is what I'm going to do. What's your reaction? And she's for it too. And I really, really like Brayden and Derek together. They have good chemistry, but in the past I was like, okay, I get the little flirty, but this felt like something a little bit more than that. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. All of it, like the earlier scene where he's, like, sleeping on the couch and all mad, like, this Derek is the Derek
sleeping on the couch and she's in the bed. I just love it.
This is the Derek that I can see, like, grocery shopping and, like, watching Netflix and stuff, if you know what I mean. Like it's not like, oh, Derek Hale who just, like, sits in a burnt out house and doesn't have any electricity or a phone. Like, this is Derek that I can see, like, using emojis and, like, you know,
oh my God,
like, you know what I mean? Like, he's just so, like, he's just so good. He's just, good.
I'm picturing him texting Scott and being like, are you okay? And that little, like, emoji where it's, like, a half smile, like, the worried, like, you know, and it's very upsetting. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I feel like this is Derek Hale could use emojis a lot. And I feel like that he actually has things that he, like, likes and doesn't like. That he's not just this ball of, like, crying anger, if you know what I mean. Like, I feel like, and it's happening more and more this season. And just watching it unfold, it's literally my favorite thing that's ever happened on Teen Wolf, is watching this happen. So I will take, like, human Derek with emotions over werewolf Derek with angst. But I don't want him to die. So they're going to have to sort something out.
Agreed.
Yeah.
All right, so another big piece of news that we got in this episode was the fact that Peter says he thinks he knows who Malia's mother is. And he calls her the Desert Wolf, which is another name for the were-coyote, so, or a coyote, but we assume that Malia's mother is a were-coyote and not just a coyote, because that would be really weird. But I have a feeling that maybe this is, well, it can't be anybody that we've met before.
Yeah.
We haven't met another were-coyote unless we've met them as a human and just don't realize that they're a supernatural being, which is definitely a possibility, but I'm really curious to know who her mother is, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, last week, or a couple of weeks ago, I started having these weird thoughts that maybe the mother is Mrs. Martin, but then I was like, I don't know what kind of age Lydia is. Like, if she was pregnant with Lydia, she couldn't have been the mother of Malia if they're around the same age, if you know what I mean. Just because they had that scene, a few scenes together, and Mrs. Martin just keeps having a bigger role. And I basically just don't want them to try and say her mother is Kate, because Kate's way too young to be her mother, and I just hope that they don't think that that's a mistake they can make, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I think I'm pretty confident that it's not Kate, if you know what I mean. Like,
well, the thing is, like, I'd been thinking it was possibly going to be Kate as well, because especially that creepy scene where Peter's, like, whispering in her ear, and I was getting really weird vibes from that. But the fact is, Kate is not a were-coyote. She never was, and what she is now is a were-jaguar, so I think that pretty solidly knocks Kate off the list.
Yeah. I mean, I hope it could be someone we haven't met before. I have no idea if there's anyone that's, you know, hanging around that we don't know about. I don't know why I got it into my head that it could be Mrs. Martin, except that, like, Peter and her had some flirtations, where they both seemed to not know each other, but, that was actually something that I asked Ian Bowen again in our little snippet interview. The character addresses it right in this episode, so he was clearly able to tell me last week. But I was like, you don't have to tell me who it is if you already know, but does Peter, at this point, know who Malia's mother is? Like, does he know who he had the baby with? Seeing as he only knows he has a child because someone else told him about it, does he know who he was seeing or, you know, sleeping with or whatever at the time? And who is it? And basically, in this episode, he gave me the same answer as he then went on to have in this episode, which is that, like, he thinks that, you know, Talia took the memory of the person as well because, you know, of reasons, and that he wants to find out who the person was, you know, just as much as who the daughter is. So yeah, that was something that was curious, because I wasn't sure up until this point whether he knew exactly, you know, who the mother was or anything like that. I you know, we like the memory of Talia Hale in general, but what on earth was so wrong/bad about this situation that the memory of it all had to be taken away, and that the child had to be taken away from the mother as well? Like, is she an untrustworthy person if she couldn't be, you know, left with her own child or something like that?
That's interesting. I hadn't considered that before, but definitely a possibility. I mean, Talia, to me, seems like somebody who is calculating in not a manipulative way. I mean, she's very wise. And so she felt the need to do this to her own brother and to basically change the course of this girl's life, Malia's life.
And why?
It had to be a big deal.
Why would she get her adopted out to people that don't know she's supernatural, if it was going to be a risk, though?
Right.
Like, if she'd end up starting to turn supernatural, that's weird. Like, maybe she
She didn't know if she was going to be supernatural or not and just took the risk anyway, because some humans are born to supernatural creatures.
Yeah, I don't know. It seems weird that she would just be adopted out as normal like that. So, yeah, I don't really know about that. But, yeah, I mean, The whole coyote thing, I mean, I guess that sort of answers the question about, you know, whether Malia is a were-coyote because she was living with coyotes, or whether it was because, you know, a were-coyote is a different thing, if you know what I mean, to a werewolf.
Yeah.
Like, we've had a lot of questions about that, whether it's just that, oh, she has a, you know, a supernatural dad, and that that's just her supernatural form because of the environment she was in, or whether, you know, there was any real other were-coyotes involved, and it seems like there was at this point.
Right, exactly. So let's talk about Lydia, because what's been happening with Lydia in the last few episodes is she's been fairly removed from the main plot, but what we get of her scenes, even though they're small, have been really concentrated, and I feel like that's exactly what happened in this episode as well, because we learn that her grandmother died in Eichenhaus, and that her grandmother heard voices too, so we assume that she's a banshee. And when Mrs. Martin gives her the urn of what she thinks is Lydia's grandmother's ashes, Lydia discovers that it's made of, or that it's mountain ash in that urn, and she realizes the entire lake house is made of mountain ash. So that was pretty significant information, I think, about her grandmother and Lydia's sort of family history.
Yeah, and I mean, the fact that her mother looked at the picture and was like, Meredith Walker, like she knew who Meredith was as well.
Yeah.
Like, what? And that was not addressed again, like, yeah,
right. So I hope it is. Yeah, but I want to clarify something, because I was recapping and I may have missed this, but Lydia's grandmother, the one that's the banshee, is
her
actually
father's
mother. Yeah. Okay,
which
I wanted to make sure.
Me as well. It surprised me mainly because it seems like the mother and Lydia are preparing to sell that house, and if it's the, like, surely it should belong to the father, if you know what I mean, like if it's his mother's. Unless they left it to Lydia specifically, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And it's actually in her name.
Could have been, right.
Yeah. But yeah, so Lydia's mother knows about Meredith Walker, and the Eichenhaus, is that something Lydia's always known, or has she only just discovered that? Like, it seems like a bit of a weird thing to just bring up, if you know what I mean. I'm surprised.
It sounds like she had known that before, because I think she was the one that said like, Grandma died in Eichenhaus, right? Or something like that. She wasn't surprised by that information.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough, I suppose. Yeah, so they knew Meredith in some way. I don't know if Meredith is immortal in some way, like if she knew her at a much younger age, if you know what I mean, if Mrs. Martin knew her at a much younger age and she still looked the same, but I mean, she's not immortal because she's dead, but maybe she didn't age unless
not
killed.
Funny, but
sorry. But, you know, maybe she didn't age unless she got killed, but I don't know. It's really weird. The mountain ash thing, I mean, her instant reaction is like, are you sure grandma's actually dead? Because these aren't her ashes. So,
I love how Mrs. Martin was like, she has to be, right? Like, even she was like, I don't know.
I mean, presumably, so what, they just got told she died and then handed a bucket of ashes? Is that how that works?
I mean, Eichenhaus, not exactly the most respectable establishment, so it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah, let's be real, that's true. So, yeah, I mean, what did you think of that then? Like, if she's, you know, she heard voices and there was, you know, she seems like she was a banshee of some sort. Do you, you know, have any thoughts on that? Like, how that ties into the end? Do we want to go through to that, or did you want to carry on with the other points before getting to that end part?
Let's wait on the end part, because that's, I think there's going to be a lot of really good discussion there. But what I wanted to say was, just really quickly, I'm really happy actually that Lydia's grandmother being a banshee is her father's mother, just because it had been bothering me for a while why Mrs. Martin hadn't said anything to her daughter, because a lot of people were thinking she got her powers from her mother.
Yeah.
And were like, why, you know, why hasn't she said anything? This is really weird. Do you think she'd want to teach her, protect her? And she knows some weird things are going on with Lydia. She must know that she's becoming a banshee, but this really explains away all of that, and I like the idea that Mrs. Martin is still sort of in the dark, because as much as I love the fact that, you know, Sheriff Stolinsky and Mama McCall are in on the secrets. I don't necessarily want that for all the characters and all the parents. I think it's more interesting and dynamic to have some people still be in the dark. So I just really like how they handled this whole family history thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to talk about moms and awesome kick-ass moms because, like, saying before, Melissa and Nishiko, they were really cool in this episode. I mean, they don't hang out a lot, but they were together, and not that either one of them really did any ass kicking per se, but they looked like they could. They looked pretty tough, and they made a pretty good duo. Mm. And Mrs. Yukimura ends up getting seriously injured and has to be flown to another hospital. And, you know, Kara just sort of says, yeah, she doesn't have the healing abilities that she used to. And it was really, really sad seeing her all bloody like that. I really like Mrs. Yukimura.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'm not really sure why that injury happened, like what that's going to serve in the plot. But
yeah,
just another bit of heightened emotion, I suppose. Or perhaps there's more to come. But
I think it's going to affect Kira. I think that's the main thing. Because I was like, what was the point of having her in this entire episode? Not even showing how she got injured and then basically being taken away off screen and Kira just telling Scott about it. I was wondering the same thing in terms of the plot. But, I mean,
it might have been a bit that got cut or something. But
yeah, which is always a possibility. But I think the fact that she was so seriously injured and she can't heal the way that she used to and she isn't the Kitsune that she used to be is going to affect Kira and maybe – like, make her make some certain decisions or something.
Yeah, going no, forward. That's true. That's true.
So we see how, once again, Peter is manipulating situations. It turns out that Kate, who went to the hospital to claim Scott's body, which we don't necessarily know why she wanted to do that, but we do know that she was checking on Scott's status for Peter to really find out if he was dead or not. And Peter didn't think that he would be. And Peter was very, very relieved that he was not dead. So what are your theories there?
I have zero theories about that, Karen. None. Like, I don't, do you, like Kate and Peter both wave their arms around being like, I'm not the benefactor. So that's, you know, whatever. I probably believe them. I don't think either of them are the benefactor.
Yeah.
I think it would be really, like, a bit obvious if Peter was being the benefactor at this point. I mean, Malia earlier asked him, you know, you're not on the list. And he's like, yeah, interesting. Like, do you think he knows why he's not on the list? Like, do you think he knows something about what's going on, even if he's not the benefactor? Is he just aware that someone else is going after all of the others? And he's just like, I'm just going to stay out of the way of this.
I don't know. I mean, it's really, really strange why Peter isn't on the list, because he obviously poses a threat. And if it's something along the terms of, like, somebody cares about him, I don't know who would care about him. That was kind of mean, but
maybe
also
the desert wolf is the benefactor.
Yeah.
So I don't know why she'd want to kill her own child.
Right, that's true. That's what I mean. I was thinking, like, oh, could it be a Hale family member that is alive that we don't know about? But wait, Derek's on the list. So it was, yeah, I don't really know what's going on with that. And it's, but my reigning theory for why Peter is relieved that Scott's not dead is that he wants to kill Scott and become an alpha. And so if Scott's dead, he can't do that.
Yeah, I thought maybe it was something like maybe he's like siphoning off power from everyone. Like if he's getting Derek's and then he'll be able to like drain Scott in some way or, you know, just kill him, whatever. But I sort of thought it might be to do with that. But I don't know. The Kate and Peter thing's really weird. It's real. I still don't really have any clue why they're doing this. Chris and Kate was really like intense.
Yes.
And them both of them being like, get out of there, Styles, like, was really like, I mean, Kate, one thing about Kate is, yeah, she's done a lot of like crazy stuff, but she really seems to not be attempting to hurt people mindlessly, if you know what I mean. Like, she really seems to not be just, you know, killing anyone that's in her way. Or at least not the people we see her interact with, which is interesting, I guess, you know?
And the people she does hurt, like the actual humans, she can't necessarily control that, which I don't think is an excuse because she could go get help, but she has her own, you know, misguided reasons for all of that. But yeah, it's, I mean, Kate is not a good guy, but she's not evil. And I've always kind of liked that about her, that she still, like, she always cared about Allison despite, you know, all of her misgivings about werewolves and, you know, wanting to turn Allison on Scott and all of that. She still loved people and she still loved her family. And obviously she cares about her brother. She doesn't want her brother to die. So it's really interesting. And I'm curious to see where they're going to take this relationship that she has with Peter, because I trust Peter a lot less than I trust Kate.
Oh yeah. I'm not sure about that. God, Stiles' face when he saw her again for the first time was so subtle. Dylan O'Brien just did this little thing with his eyes that was just like, I hate you and I just don't trust you. And it was just really, really subtle and brilliant. It just reminded me of, like, actually something like a, not a discrepancy, but something that has always been interesting to me that made me wonder about what kind of conversations has happened between this, you know, people off screen, like not the cast, but like the characters off screen. Because in season, I guess, 3A, Stiles snaps at Derek when they got Jennifer, you know, being like, you know, oh, your psycho girlfriend, like, you know, who turned into a mass murderer, like second one, by the way. Like, he knew about Kate and Derek. But in this season, we find out that Scott did not know. So why would Stiles have known that and not Scott, if you know what I mean? I don't know whether he would have even known it from something to do with the case, like his dad or something like that, or if Derek, you know, maybe off screen, like Stiles and Derek had some crazy moment and Derek told him, if you know what I mean? But
yeah.
I just found it interesting that he knew that whole story. Stiles always knows the full story, but like he knew that whole story and Scott didn't, if you know what I mean? But just Stiles' reaction seeing Kate was pretty subtle but intense, basically.
Yeah, I wonder if he just, like, put two and two together or something like that. I don't know. I mean, Stiles is really smart. He tends to have more information than most of the other characters and just, you know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure. But speaking of Peter, Malia is, you know, afraid that she's gonna be like Peter. She comes back to Stiles. She sort of reluctantly helps him, and she doesn't seem like she necessarily wants to be there, but at the same time she is there. So I have to wonder if she forgives Stiles for keeping that information from her that she was Peter's daughter.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't get a very good read on that scene of, like, why she was there, or if, you know, if just she had no one else to go or talk to, or whether she was sort of more at peace with it after talking to Peter. But yeah, I don't really know. I don't feel like it got much closure, so I think there's probably more to come there.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely a bump in the road for their relationship. So end of the episode, Scott and Kira think that the benefactor is a banshee because a banshee wouldn't necessarily have to have visual confirmation in order to know if somebody is dead. And we have the whole situation with Scott pretending to be dead but not really being dead and it not really drawing out the benefactor. So that's sort of how they come to that conclusion. And this is when Mrs. Martin gives Lydia a note from her grandmother, and this note, just this, you know, nonsense sort of scribblings on this piece of paper is actually the code that the lists had been written in. And so, I mean, the big question here is, obviously, is Lydia's grandmother the benefactor? Is she still alive?
How long ago is she meant to have died? Is it, like, just in the last few months or something? Or, like,
I don't think so. To me, it sounded like quite maybe like a childhood death.
Yeah,
because the fact
that she was like, oh, they wanted you to do this on your 18th birthday, if you know what I mean. Like it.
Yeah.
So it was a bit strange. But I don't know. I don't know why she would be the. You know, that would make sense in terms of the names being stuff that's close to Lydia. You know, if it is the grandmother kind of haunting her or whatever. But why would she want Lydia to be able to figure it out? Like, what is she trying to achieve here, basically? Like,
why
would she want to kill other banshees and Lydia herself is on the list? Like,
right, exactly. I don't think that Lydia's grandmother's the benefactor, basically because Lydia is also on the list. I mean, that just doesn't really make sense to me. I wonder if Lydia's grandmother had, if she made this list in order to sort of like track the supernatural creatures of Beacon Hills to like keep an eye on them, protect them, you know, just to know that they were there, and then ended up like it falling into somebody else's hands.
Supplying someone with the content.
Right, that information. Yeah. And they put the bounties on everybody and used that information in order to start checking people off the list.
Yeah, I could probably see that. But yeah, it was pretty confusing, and now I need to know what that code says. Now, is this the thing that someone was saying to me on Twitter that we were predicted correctly?
It was about like her grandmother, right?
We always kind of assumed that the grandmother was a banshee. I don't know if it was that simple. Did we say something about the benefactor, like, or talking to someone after being dead? Like, I can't remember specifically what that
was. I'm not sure. The Twitter username is Holy Cow, it's Jen. So please tell us what you meant. Because
yeah, I'm sure that there's something, you know, I'm sure that there's something there. Like, I definitely know we've talked about Grandma being a banshee before.
Yeah.
But if there was something more specifically that we were, like, on point about, I wanna know. So, yeah. I can't think of anything right now. But, yeah, I don't know. I found, just going back to, like, Malia and Stiles, that last scene as well, that whole conversation that she had about the things that she said to her, like, adoptive mother before getting into the car. Like, I just found that very, very sad. And Stiles saying to her, like, that killing doesn't run in the family. Like, killing doesn't run in your family. And she's like, maybe it does in my family. Like, she clearly doesn't know too much about the Hales, if you know what I mean, because it's not really something that runs in that family either. It's just that one crazy man. So, I don't know. I just... That kind of opening up with that vulnerability, I guess, that she showed with telling that story, you know, maybe they are going to be okay, like, you know, cross your fingers anyway, but I don't really know at this point. I don't really know. Also, like, where are Lydia's grandmother's ashes if she's not dead? Or, I mean, if she's dead or whatever, like, if she's alive, like, I don't know, man. I can't. I don't know if I can take any more new characters.
I'm really excited for the next episode. I mean, not just because it sounds like it's going to focus on Parrish or that Parrish is going to be part of it, but to hopefully wrap up some of these questions. I mean, it's episode 9, so a lot of big things usually go down in episode 9, and I just really, really want to know more about Lydia's family, more about Malia's mother, and I don't know if that's going to be something that's going to be, you know, revealed right away or not, but I'm really curious. They did a really good job of keeping these mysteries really relevant and sort of dragging them out slowly throughout the episodes.
Yeah, I don't even know if Malia's mother is something that we'll find out this season or if it'll be a part of this plot or if it'll be something for the future, but...
Yeah.
No.
Well, we don't have any specific feedback this episode, but I saw a lot of comments about how people loved this episode a lot, that it was one of their favorites, and I definitely have to agree it was a great episode, so there's that.
I found it very different. Like, I found it very unusual, and I really did enjoy it. Like, a lot of aspects of it I thought was really cool. This one was written by Angela Harvey, who I hope that we can get on sometime later in the season to talk about, you know, just writing for the show in general or her opinions on what's going on. I also know that Alyssa, who we had on last week, is very attached to this Derek storyline. Like, she was a pretty big contributor to that Derek.
Thank you,
plot.
Alyssa.
So, yeah, we're gonna send her a fruit basket or something, because oh my god, I'm still not over Derek Hale. I liked him being like, I don't like guns, because yeah. I don't know, I just liked everything. I love everything.
But he was like, I've been shot too many times to like guns.
Oh, I don't know. I sound so stupid and fangirly and but like I just really appreciate him. I just can't even put into words how funny I think he is. And not in a like funny, outright funny ha-ha way, if you know what I mean. I just find him absolutely brilliant and I just love him. Oh, anyway. Yeah. Next week, Perishable. Not looking forward to that, honestly. I'm never looking forward to this show. I'm like, oh, don't bring me the next episode. It'll be traumatic. But yeah, I mean, hopefully it'll be good. I hope, cross my fingers, that it'll be good. But yeah, if they do anything that hurts Parrish, or if he turns out to be evil, I will not be sending a fruit basket.
We're basically going to quit the show if that happens.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they'll listen to us, right? You know, they've got time to go back and fix it up, you know, reshoot everything and make it go the direction that we want them to before next week.
I would say so.
Yeah, I hope so.
Do you have a non sequitur question for us?
Yes, I will ask you a non sequitur question. You did art history and stuff at college, yes?
Yes.
Do you have a favorite, like, artist from a certain era, whether it's a, you know, either postmodern or further back, like either, you know, European 17th century or, you know, 19th century American or whatever? Do you have a favorite sort of classic artist or artwork?
Oh, or artwork. Wow, that's hard. Well, I mean, a lot of my focus has always been on Greek and Roman art, specifically Greek art, because basically Roman art is just a knockoff of Greek art.
Like ancient
yes.
stuff. Okay.
Yeah, so that's always been something that I've really, really been interested in. I love Nike of Samothrace, which is, if you guys don't know, just the statue of this woman without, like, a head and arms, and she's just got big wings, and she's got this beautiful sort of, like, draped dress, and it's in the Louvre when you walk up the stairs, and it was like, I can't even tell you the feeling that I got when I saw it in real life. It was absolutely incredible. But, you know, I would say in terms of artists, because we don't know a lot of the artists from ancient Greece, nothing was really signed and it wasn't like, you know, how it was later on. I would say the high Renaissance in Italy is probably one of my favorite time periods. Mm-hmm. And I really like Botticelli. He did The Birth of Venus and La Primavera and a lot of just really interesting pieces of artwork. And he uses a lot of, like, symbols and stuff in his artwork. And he does a lot of Greek, like, Greek influences, obviously, with, like, Aphrodite and The Birth of Venus and, you know, that sort of thing. So I would say he's probably one of my favorites. I really like Artemisia Gentileschi as well, because I think she had a really interesting life and was an incredibly talented artist. And I should probably stop saying people now. That was like three or four.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's really hard to like decide, especially when you've studied this stuff for like 4 years and you're like, yeah. I just like everything.
Yeah, that's nice. Learning.
What about you?
I have a few. As well. I can tell you many or whatever. Yeah, so I've got a few different periods as well that I'm a big fan of. Right from childhood, I've been very into, like, I think since probably year, like, five, like, fifth grade or whatever, since being in art class there and watching documentary or whatever, the Impressionist era, basically. So, you know, very, very big fan of Van Gogh and his sadness. But my favorite Impressionist is Pizarro, probably. I also like Monet, but not the, like, typical Monet stuff. Like, not the, like, when you think of Monet, you think of, like, water lilies and, like, 15 paintings of the same bridge. Monet, he did this series of paintings of when he was living in London, and Monet's paintings of London are some of my favorite paintings of London ever, and so I really like those. Eugène Delacroix, who was a French, like, romantic painting, he did a lot of paintings from the French Revolution and stuff like that. He has a painting called Liberty Leading the People, which is actually one of the inspirations for Victor Hugo writing Les Mis, but he has lots and lots of different art as well that I like. And I legit, they moved one of his paintings from the main Louvre to this Louvre, mini Louvre in another city in France. And I legitimately considered going to this city just to see this, but I didn't get to do it at the time. But the other era I really like is a collection of people, British artists, I think it was 18th century, like maybe 1700s, called the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. That was like Millet, Dante Gabriel Rossetti, William Holman Hunt, a bunch of people. They were like, they basically were this little club of dudes who sort of came along and started doing a certain art style. They kind of brought back a lot of like naturalistic style, and when it was in the middle of a really formal, like the only art that was respected was this really formal kind of thing, and they were just a really strange, hilarious group of guys. They had like a little gang symbol that they put into all their paintings. Like anyone who was in the club got to use this little, not a gang symbol, but like a little, basically a little brand, like a little initial. It was like PRB, like Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. It's so stupid. They're like, it's like something, it would be like seeing a group like, I don't know, like Team Star Kid or something like that in the 1700s, if you know what I mean. Like this little independent group of young guys and women as well, actually, who were like just breaking out on their own, and some of them were just, they have really funny life stories as well. There's actually going to be a movie coming out later this year, I think, called Effie, which is about Effie Gray, who, this woman that was married to an art critic who she had a really bad relationship with him and ended up sort of splitting up with him because he was a pedophile, and marrying Millet, and that should be good. But there's been other films about them and stuff like that. They all had really interesting lives, and they're all kind of very free and liberal, and it was, I don't know, I just find them hilarious, and I have a lot of emotional attachment to them. So, and they're like, I know their work all so well that like if I see a painting in a gallery by one of them, I can usually tell not only who painted it but who the model in the painting is. Like I can go, oh wow. That's like, because they knew a lot of the same girls and stuff like that, and so like you'll get like the same girl who modeled for like five different paintings, and I'll be able to identify who the, not just the painter is, but who the model in the painting is. So yeah, I'm quite into the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. look, I had good question today. I didn't have to look around my room and think things. I mean, I actually do have a lot of postcards by these various artists on my walls, like from galleries, like little, you know, postcard samples of the paintings. So there's that. But I also really love, this is just a little niche in terms of modern art, there's an Australian artist called Brett Whiteley who also had a tragic life story, because many artists do. He's like my dad, one of my dad's favorite artists. My dad is an actual practicing artist, and this is one of my dad's favorite artists, and he's very, very famous in Australia, and I sort of grew up knowing about him, and I guess I like him too. But yeah, that's my answer for that question.
Awesome.
Cool. All right. So next week, episode Perishable. Yeah, as I said, might be the week we finally quit the show. We threaten it all the time, but it might happen.
The highest chance so far will be next week. There's a fair chance.
Yeah, pretty much. All right. Well, in that case, I suppose we will see you all later. And yeah, you know, maybe come back next week if we haven't decided to send the opposite of fruit baskets to Teen Wolf for torturing our baby Parrish. Who is more important to you right now, Parrish or human Derek?
Oh no.
I'm gonna have to say human Derek, but
I think I do too, just because like he's been a character since season one. That was really mean.
Sorry, I like to ask the hard questions. Okay, we'll go. Alright. So bye-bye, Karen.
Bye.
Bye.
Welcome to a special addendum to Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, episode number 76. Today we have Betsy Thompson and Gabe Fleming with us, who are from the production team of Teen Wolf. So, hi guys, how are you doing?
Good.
Hello, great. Thank you for having us on.
Oh, thank you for coming on. It's always really exciting when we can get people from the show to get on the podcast and tell us a little bit about what they do, especially the people who do behind the scenes stuff, because, you know, that I don't think a lot of people know about what the kinds of things that you guys do.
Well, even people here at Teen Wolf don't know the kinds of things that we do. So
we're the unsung heroes.
That's right.
Yes. Well, I'm a copy editor by trade, so I know how you guys feel. Oftentimes when there are no problems and your name doesn't come up in conversations, it's kind of like the best compliment that you can get. But right. It also makes it hard to be like, well, I did help a lot, you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And editing is such a mysterious craft for people who not only aren't in the industry, but are in the industry. And people don't really understand what we do. And it's awfully hard to explain.
Actually going to be my first question. I mean, what is your official title and what is it that you guys actually do?
All right.
So, I'm an editor on the show and, I edit the show. And maybe I'll explain that. So we'll let Betsy say what she does.
I'm Betsy, and I am Gabe's assistant. I am an assistant editor.
So do we want to say what assistant editing is first?
Sure. So I basically I do a little bit of everything as far as prepping. I basically do everything that Gabe needs to get his job done. So I get the footage in, and I organize it the way that he likes it to be organized and kind of prep all the scenes for him so he can kind of jump in and see what was shot. And then once all the dailies are done, which is what we call them, then I jump into more like helping out with sound effects and script syncing and pretty much anything that makes his life a little bit easier. And then we get to the point where the show's done. I'll send out outputs and send to our online house, which does all our color and finalizing and audio mix and all that stuff. I do all the deliveries to them. So,
right.
I don't know. So I sort of do a little bit of everything. I do some paperwork. That's not the most exciting thing to do, but
paperwork, organization. Yeah.
Lots of organization, lots of just kind of, I feel like one of my big jobs is just to kind of know what's going on with the episode at all times. Cause you have a ton of different people that will be asking, cause people try, they're not always successful, but they try to leave Gabe alone to kind of do his thing. So they'll come and
right.
ask me like, hey, what's going on with this?
Right.
So, yeah.
Betsy's the buffer.
Yeah, exactly. So I try to know what's going on.
Yeah. So the process is basically, so they'll shoot something and then goes to these dailies people and they sync the sound with the picture, and then they bring it to Betsy, and then she puts it all. We use a Avid Media Composer, which is the most commonly used software for editing in Hollywood, and she'll put it in, organize it so that I can see clearly all the shots, what angle they're at, all of that stuff. Then we edit it, and then part of my job after the editing process is to coordinate with the visual effects people and let them know what Jeff wants, what the director wants, and what I want, and then kind of give them notes as they send in versions of visual effects shots, and the same thing with the composer. So I'll provide a temp score for the composer, which consists largely of older Teen Wolf music, but then partially of other scores. I like to use a lot of Steve Jablonski, who does the Transformer scores, and Hans Zimmer, of course, who does, Batman and everything else.
Yeah.
So we'll have that. And then, the composer will send us music, and we'll kind of give story notes to the composer, like, we need to have a hit here, we need to have this moment here, and interface with Jeff also in all of these points. And then it goes to color correction, which I go to and supervise the color correction. And then it goes to the mix, which I go to and supervise the mix. And then finally it all comes together in one, piece that then Jeff will come and watch it all down and give final little tweaky notes. But that's generally the process. Kind of not ignoring the biggest part in the middle, which is the editing process.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's interesting that you bring up the soundtrack because, we're a part of Hypeable.com, so we get a lot of press stuff. And one of the things that we sometimes get from you guys are screeners. And the screeners, they always tell us, this is not the finished copy. This is as close as we can get it until, it actually goes on air. So just be mindful that, some things could be a little wonky. And, we were watching it one time. We were like, isn't that a score from another movie? I think somebody said it was Winter Soldier or something. And we were like, what's going on with that? And then we figured out later that it was just a placeholder, but it was a really interesting look into what you guys have to do to sort of get it to the point where, it makes sense. I mean, the music actually did a really good job underscoring the scene that it was in. But, to go in later and add in the actual music for the episode, it was just a cool behind-the-scenes look for me, because I find all of this really interesting.
Music has become a big part of the editor's job these days. It didn't used to be. It used to be the editor was primarily in charge of cutting picture, and then there would be other people who did music and sound effects and all of that, and that would happen later in the process just because of the technology at the time. When you were editing on a flatbed with film, it was very difficult to incorporate music into your cut. But these days with computers, that job is kind of sliding more and more towards the editor to create a cohesive whole. And that's true in television and also in big movies. Although in big budget movies, they'll have a music editor and a sound effects person working with the editor simultaneously. But yeah, we have to deliver. My goal is to deliver to the director an airable show. That's what I always want to do. Is this, we could put this on the air right now, and it would, feel like a real piece of television, which is a lot of work.
I can imagine.
Yeah. I mean, right now I'm working on the finale, and one of my jobs today is to try and score the second half of the show, which has a lot of fighting and a lot of action sequences. And it's very exciting, and I'm just kind of looking around at different scores. I said I'm a big Steve Jablonski fan, so I'm looking at the Transformers 4 score right now, which is very good. the movie may not be, but the score is. So yeah, it's, I mean, I like working with the music. It's one of my favorite things.
And Gabe is awesome at it too. He's a great music editor.
Here's your $5.
Thank you.
yeah.
Now, it's my understanding, Betsy, that 408, Time of Death, which is the episode that just aired, was actually your first co-editor credit, right?
That is correct, yes.
Okay, so what's the difference between being a co-editor versus, you know, just an assistant editor?
There's a pretty big difference. For the co-editor...
Just to clarify, it was a full editor credit. Not co-editor, full editor, and shared with me.
Yes, we shared it.
Yeah.
So basically for that episode, Gabe was gracious enough to give me lots of scenes to cut. And
Two acts.
And so I basically was edited part of the show, so I got an editor credit, which was really, it was really fun. It was a really good experience for me. So
that's great.
Not all assistant editors want to be editors, but a lot of them do. So it's assisting is a pathway towards editing.
Yeah. So also that's another thing about assisting is it's great to work under an editor who cares and will throw you stuff. Like Gabe will give me stuff to do and he'll always give me notes and sort of help guide me to become a better editor so that one day I will be able to make that leap.
Yeah.
You know, so it's also sort of a mentorship a little bit, especially in TV and movies where you have your assistant and editor. Ideally that's what it should be. I know that not all relationships are like that, but
yeah, it's hard to, you almost kind of wish that it could be more. In the old days, the job of the first assistant editor was to sit next to the editor all day long and watch them edit and just be there to, because in the old days you had, you know, this a flatbed editor, which uses actual film. And then there would be all of the various clips from the film would be hanging in this bin next to the editing, the flatbed. So it was the assistant's job to know where those were and pick them out of the bin. So the editor would say like, oh, we need that shot of the this and this and this. And the assistant would go, okay, go find it. And then, you know, so it was a much more in-depth mentorship process to be a first assistant editor. These days you're in a different room because it's the job of assistant editing is kind of switched to more of a computer and organizational task. So it's important that assistants get that kind of mentorship somehow in other means, you know.
Yeah. And the idea is still the same. Like Gabe will call me, we're next door to each other, but he'll call me and be like, hey, where's this shot or where's this footage, you know? And ideally I would know where that stuff is. I mean,
You're the only one who's actually seen everything.
Yeah. So I pretty much watch all the footage down. Because when I'm doing dailies at the beginning of the process, you know, I go through and I mark when they say action and I mark when they restart a scene. And so to do that, you have to kind of watch the whole thing down.
Right.
So you get a good idea of like where things are and everything. So if your editor does ask you, hey, did they shoot this? You have a good idea. You know, they shoot a ton of footage on Teen Wolf, though,
oh my God.
It's not always easy to remember everything.
Yeah.
But yes, that is ideally, you know, another part of my job. So
every episode is shot like a movie.
It's true.
They shoot so much.
Well, you know, speaking of Time of Death specifically, and I know you guys are several episodes ahead of the rest of us, so if it's a little hard to remember, it's okay. But what are some of the highs and lows of editing this episode for both of you guys?
Can we talk about the surveillance stuff?
Oh, the surveillance stuff.
Yeah, can we talk about that?
Sure.
That was the high. I mean, that's, it was so unique.
That was fun.
That was one of the highs for me. But when they're looking at the surveillance footage on the computers, That is actually the post-production team. We went in a few weeks ago.
We participated in a little bit of shooting for that, but we were all the people who were in the surveillance footage was all of the editors and assistant editors on Teen Wolf.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
If you look at that stuff, you know, frame by frame, you'll see Betsy and me and Ed.
We're tiny, but
yeah, we're tiny. We're barely visible.
But we had a little cameo.
All the doctors and patients in the hospital that are wandering around the hall.
So that's a fun fact.
Yeah, yeah.
That's great. That's really interesting. That's the sort of thing that people really love to learn, you know, is the little behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what else of this episode. It was a while ago. This is a while ago.
Yeah.
Flashbacks.
The flashback scenes. The flashback scenes were fun to try. I mean, for me, I had, you know, I always look in every episode for a little opportunity to do something different and to just do some editorial, do something creative editorially. And that episode was the bit when Scott is waking back up and he's right after he's been hacking Liam. And there's all the blood on his face and it's kind of a blurry, flashy. I don't know. Did you watch it just recently?
Yeah. The part where like Kira is intercut, like as she's waking him up.
Right, yeah, that's a lot of superimpositions, and that took forever to do.
Well, it looks great, so, I mean, there's that, at least.
Yeah, what else is in this episode? Yeah, we're looking at our board, where we have the scene group.
Was there anything in this episode that was really difficult for you guys, besides, you know, the intercutting, or anything that you feel like... you know, scenes you really didn't want to cut, or just something that had to be done for like time constraints, anything like that?
This episode was pretty straightforward, to be honest. It wasn't, I mean, there are a lot of challenging episodes, and I mean, I'm coming into the finale right now. It's so dense that just presents a challenge in and of itself. But 408, Time of Death, which we call 408, I think it was pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I mean, the
gun sex scene, which is what we call it. We give little names for every scene, you know, so.
I love that.
Yeah, so we call, like, the scene 29, which is when, you know, they're shooting the Braden and Derek are playing with the guns. We call that the gun sex scene. That was fun to do because they were, you know, Megan and Hecklin both had really good performances in that scene, and they were, it's fun to do kind of a sexy, flirty scene. What else? The fight stuff on the roof was, that's an example of that footage was that the fight choreography was so short for that scene. We had to take an approach of extending it by using more slow-mo and making it a little bit dreamier, because if we had just played it straightforward, like we often do, it would have been over in about 8 seconds.
Right.
So that was a little bit of editorial license in extending it into a more of a, it's almost dreamy.
Yeah.
And we used a lot of slow motion and kind of made it more about drama than about the actual choreography or the fight.
Yeah. And I worked on some of the Peter and Malia stuff, and I really liked that. I enjoyed doing that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Scenes between them in the vault.
Yeah.
That was fun because they're both really great. And it was a good relationship, you know. I really like cutting interesting relationship stuff.
Yeah.
You know.
And those scenes are challenging just because they were really long.
Yeah.
For Teen Wolf, like they were 3 minutes or so, which is a very, very long time for our show. We don't usually have, you know, most shows do, but our show, their scenes are usually very fast.
Yeah, 2.5 pages for one scene or something.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Very long, but fun. Fun stuff.
Now, we were talking before about screeners and all of that. And, you know, having seen screeners and then seeing the final product, it's really easy to see how even just the tiniest additions or subtractions from certain scenes can make huge changes in the overall feel of an episode. So I was just wondering, you know, because like editing seems like your chance to really take a scene or even an entire episode one way or maybe even a completely other way. How much input do like Jeff or the other writers, the directors have in terms of the editing? I know you mentioned before that usually they come in maybe after and kind of give you like, you know, little notes, but is that usually how it goes or are they much more involved in that process?
Well, they're pretty involved. Jeff is, the other writers aren't as much, a little bit. Basically what happens is, we'll do the editor's cut, which is essentially a finished show. It'll usually be a little bit over time. We'll have maybe 2 to 4 minutes longer than, you know, we're allowed to air. And then the director will come in and you work with the director for a few days and they'll do their notes. And then Jeff will come in and do his notes and that'll take a few days. So yeah, they have a lot of input, but you know, it's like the editor's cut probably gets changed by 5%, 10% in the end. With television, there's not a lot of time to really make changes. Like if you're working on a feature film, the editor usually delivers a cut by the end of production before the director even comes back. And the director will, in that case, have time to watch every take and really go through things and try different approaches with different scenes. But in television, there just isn't that time. So it's really up to the editor to set what it is. And there's only time for the director and the executive producer to just alter what they have a problem with or what bothers them, or if there's a scene that they really, really saw in a certain way and the editor cut it in a different way, then they can change that. But really, I mean, it's almost one of the nice things about editing in television is they're kind of stuck with what you did.
Stuck with your choices. Yeah, but these guys all know what Jeff likes pretty well, you know, so
yeah.
Everyone kind of, Gabe and Alyssa when she was editing and Ed have all been on the show since the beginning, right?
Almost. I came in
season 2. You came in and out,
yeah.
But, and then John and Kim are newer editors, you know, even that they have learned, I mean, you learn pretty quickly, you know?
Yeah.
So it's definitely a creative, there's creative freedom there, but then you also sort of.
Yeah. I would say like,
things that he would like.
For example, you know, they shoot probably 10 takes of every single line, 10 to 20, you know, if you include all the different camera angles. So the editor will choose the takes and the performance, and then, you know, the director will maybe change three or four takes out of the show, and then Jeff will maybe go through and want to change, you know, another 10. So, and then there will be kind of bigger story points. Like the directors always want to change things about the camera angle, or, you know, if they want to put a wide in at a certain point, or there's a shot that they really liked that we didn't use, we'll put that in. And then Jeff was kind of more about, story elements. So that's always the thing when Jeff comes into the room, he'll watch it and be like, oh, well, this is supposed to, you know, right now you've got it going A, C, D. It's supposed to go A, D, C. And we go, oh, okay, well, let's do it that way. So Jeff's notes are mostly about story and then, and music actually a lot.
Yeah.
He's very specific with music.
Right. Yeah, we actually had the chance to talk to Laura Webb in the past, who's the music supervisor. Yeah. And it was really interesting learning about how she chooses the music and how that sort of gets put into the show. And then she also said how Jeff comes in and, you know, he'll have sort of his own vision and they'll work together on that. But what can you say about the track and the score for editing purposes?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of songs, so the editor, I mean, we'll do a temp score for, you know, for the orchestral type music, and then Dino, the composer, will, you know, replace it or use close to what we did, and then Laura is a separate process where we're looking for places to put songs in the show. And yeah, I mean, basically the process is we'll look for scenes that could potentially have a song. We'll tell them to Laura and we'll go over, we'll watch the scenes with Laura. Then she'll go off and she'll come back with, you know, five or six options for each of those scenes. And then we'll work with them. We'll put them against the picture and see what they feel like. And then kind of cut it together. And then Jeff will see it and he'll say, yes or no, you know, he usually says yes. Sometimes it's a real struggle to find the right track. Every episode, there's one track that is just impossible to find. Like actually with Time of Death, I had originally wanted to try putting songs in for the dream sequences. And I had a version like that for a while, but it wasn't perfect. It just never quite gelled. And in the end, Jeff's just said, well, let's just do score for this instead. Which was, you know, I would have liked to have done songs, but I agreed in the end, we didn't find quite the right thing. So we just didn't do it. But then for example, at the end of the episode, we had a really great, like that was an easy placement, but it's a song that plays over the last few scenes and it ties together, when Derek is getting up and looking at the guns. And when Malia is talking to Styles about, you know, that she feels like maybe she's a murderer like her dad. And then Scott and Kira finally talking about that they think they have more information about who the benefactor is. So that song was a nice, you know, piece that just ties everything in together. And you'll notice in the end how the lyrics happen between each line of dialogue between Scott and Kira. So that's another little music editing task where you really try and have the music highlighted at a certain point when you can hear it and have it get out of the way when you need to pay attention to other things. So
this is extremely challenging.
Oh my God. Yeah,
it sounds somewhat simple, but it is a very hard thing to do to really make it so you can appreciate the song and the scene at the same time.
Yeah.
It sounds tedious.
I don't know if it's tedious. I enjoy that. It's very challenging. And it's very frustrating when there's a song that you really want to use that you can't make work because it doesn't have the right structure or it doesn't have the right, you know, pauses or moments of silence. That happens quite frequently where you've got this great track that's just perfect for the scene in the way it feels but you just can't put it in because it doesn't have the right moments. There was a 3A, I guess, when Allison, I don't know if you remember this scene, when Allison it's right after her mom dies, the episode after, and she's kind of throws away her girlish things where she knocks all the, you know, photos and things off her desk and throws away a lot of her clothes and then gets out her crossbow and her weapons. So that scene, we had a Zola Jesus song that was, you know, Laura found this song for us that was really powerful for that moment. And very dark and it felt right for her care for Allison's character moment in that moment. And it didn't have quite the right structure. Like it needed to build more. So what we ended up doing is contacting, I don't know if that's a real name, but Zola Jesus, and seeing if we could add a little bit to the song, just a little bit of drums, just so that we can make it feel bigger towards the end. Just so that we could add a little bit of structure so that it felt like it got bigger and bigger and bigger to make Allison's transformation feel more real. And the artist said that we could do it, and it was great. And we, Dino, just kind of added a little bit of just augmented a little bit.
Wow, that's awesome.
We don't get to do that very often, though.
So I know that you were talking about your guys are working on the finale right now, and you were sort of like, fight scenes, which I can imagine would be fairly difficult to edit together. But which scenes do you guys find the most fun to edit?
I actually really enjoy fight scenes. I mean, I think that the couple things that I really enjoy what I call like high drama, which is extremely, extremely intense scenes. I think one of my favorite scenes to cut was in episode 305 when Scott is in the bathroom off of the bus and he dies essentially and Allison has to sew him back up. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that scene? Like, and then Victoria shows up and tells her to, you know, get it together and stop shaking. That was one of my favorite scenes to cut, just because Crystal did such an amazing job with that scene, and she had a real ability to bring that high drama where it really elevated the performance in the show, and it brought it to this level where, you know, it's almost like Shakespearean, and that's really fun to work with for me, is to get that fine work where you're really working with a good performance, and you're trying to get it to be the absolute pinnacle of what it can be, and work with the tiniest details of how the emotion flows and how there can be surprising things in it. Like, and there's a little moment in that scene where she kind of she has this strange exhalation where she just goes, ah, you know, she can't hold it together. And that was one of my favorite things that I, in that scene, that I really fought for, was to keep this oddness in it, because it felt so real to me. And I think that's my favorite kind of thing to do.
I like, I mean, I'm still learning what I like, you know, I'm still very early in my,
right.
But, I really like, creepy stuff, like creepier scenes.
Yeah. Horror. Yeah.
But then I really also like, relationship moments and like character moments, any sort of romantic relationships or family relationships. Like, I don't know. There's something about like developing those scenes between the actors when it's all well done and everything. It's, I don't know. It's fun for me to do that and kind of see what I can find in their performance, like what they gave me, you know?
Yeah.
To put back in there.
Find those little moments.
And, that's fun and challenging, but you know, like I said, there's much more for me to learn and do out there. But
I also really like, I said before, I always look for opportunities to add editorially to an episode. And I think those are my other favorite moments to edit. Like, in last season's, finale in 324, what was it called?
Oh gosh, I have no idea.
I don't know. was the hospital, the Oni hospital hallway massacre.
Oh yeah.
So that's the scene where Styles comes in and is looking for Melissa McCall, and then it kind of goes into this slow motion, the Oni going down the hallway hacking people to bits.
Oh man, that is, I mean, so many people love that scene so much, between the slow mo and the music and just how everything played out. That is definitely a fan favorite.
Well, that was, I feel like that's one of my prouder Teen Wolf contributions is that originally it was supposed to be a normal, you know, full speed fight scene, you know, like, you know, and I was just kind of like, wow, they shot this whole thing in slow-mo and it's really crazy looking. And I just saw a few little snippets of it in slow-mo. And I was like, oh, let's do a song to this. Let's make this like a real creepy, slow, like nastiness and put a song to it. So then I contacted Laura and I was like, we need to get a track for this. And she came into my room and just, we started playing some music and she played that track, started playing it on her laptop. And we were like, oh yeah, weren't sure we could get it because it was expensive, because it was Creedence Clearwater. But and then just kind of putting that together and that I think is like, that's one of those editorial things that you can, that's part of the, you know, that's an example, I think, of what editors do is taking something like that footage and then going, oh, okay, what can we do with this? What's the approach that's going to elevate this past the sum of its parts?
And the editor, in a way, is kind of the final writer of the episode. Like,
yeah,
they sort of see everything that as it comes together and make adjustments as necessary to make the for whatever is best for the story, you know?
Yeah.
And the show. And so there is a lot of little decisions that can be made by the editor that really impacts like what you guys see. I mean,
oh yeah. And I think that's almost more true in other shows and films. Cause Teen Wolf is, the scripts are really tight. So there's not really a lot that we need to cut or can cut, in terms of lines, but a lot of other things that I've worked on, man, one of the editor's first job is just to cut dialogue, just to throw it out, you know, if it can be eliminated. That's one of the main editorial jobs is to kind of manage the storytelling flow and how the script ends up. So I always suggest to any editor that they learn screenwriting and they write a screenplay, because that really, you need to know three act structure and you need to know all of the mechanics of storytelling in a grander scale than just scene work.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, speaking of like deleted scenes and that stuff, you just mentioned that. We have to ask, because a lot of people wonder this, you know, is there a bunch of deleted stuff that you guys have ever thought about, you know, putting online or putting on the DVDs? Because people really love seeing that kind of stuff and they would probably flock to like MTV.com and watch those over and over again.
We get asked, you know, we get asked for deleted scenes quite a bit. And I mean, the truth is we honestly don't have.
We don't have them.
We don't have, I mean, maybe we'll have like one a season.
Yeah.
But I mean, really, that's even rare.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy how few scenes we delete.
Yeah.
Well, the deleted elements are usually a line here or there that you don't notice missing. So there's no, like, it just wouldn't be interesting to show.
By itself, right?
But yeah, there's a reason why they were cut short. You know, they're usually shorter and better.
They usually end up, by the time we get it down to the airable length, it's I mean, we've toyed with that in the past. We're like, okay, well, for the DVD, we're going to have a longer version. And then we'll kind of go back and look at the older extended version and be like, eh. Yeah. No, the one that aired is better. So, yeah, I know it's kind of disappointing not to have deleted scenes, but it's just not part of the Teen Wolf process. I think it's just something that, you know, they delete the scenes in the writer's room.
Right. And I think that's interesting in and of itself, the fact that the scripts are so tight and you guys don't have to worry about that kind of thing. I think in a lot of ways that's, you know, just really great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it makes it difficult when you do have to take time out just because they are so tight, it makes it harder to remove things.
Right.
So because you can't just remove a scene and have the rest of the episode make sense. So it presents challenges in and of itself, whereas some shows you could just like kick out a whole 5-minute chunk and no one would notice. But here the plots are so intricate in every episode that
every scene plays a pivotal role.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, I think Jeff does that on purpose, so we can't cut any of his scenes. So important in.
Yeah.
Every single one.
Yeah.
So, final question for you guys. Last week we had Alyssa Clark on, who is obviously one of the writers, but she actually started off as an editor and transitioned into the writer's room. So, have either of you guys had any interests in maybe, you know, looking into another part of the production of the show and maybe starting to transition your way over there?
Gabe should direct, but I don't know if he wants to.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's actually a fairly common path for editors to go on to direct television shows. It's complicated. It's complicated. I think the main reason, I'm a filmmaker. I directed a few features of my own, like really, really low budget features. The problem is you have to be in the Directors Guild to direct an episode of Teen Wolf or almost every other television show. And the restrictions of the Directors Guild are such that you essentially can't make no budget films after you've joined. So that's the dilemma that I face, is that I would like to continue making my own work outside of Teen Wolf. So it's unfortunate. I mean, there's a lot of – the unions are very restrictive in a lot of ways. On the whole, they're greatly to our benefit. But there's a few little trade-offs like that make it a little frustrating.
Yeah.
But.
And I don't know. I honestly just would like to be an editor one day. And then who knows from there, you know. I haven't really thought beyond that, but I think that's probably my end goal at the moment. But who knows if that will change. So.
Right. There's always room to maneuver. And from what we've heard from a lot of different people, actually, Jeff and a lot of the team are really open to helping people do that sort of thing, move up and move on and forward and everything. So hopefully both you guys at some point will have a chance to do something like that.
We shall see.
Well, anything else you guys want to say before we head out of here?
I don't know. Keep watching Teen Wolf.
I don't think you'll have any trouble with the people that listen to us doing that. So yeah, we all love the show so much and really excited every week to see what comes out of it. And now we have a better idea of what goes on behind the scenes, so we can kind of understand all the work that goes into it.
Well, you know, actually, the one other thing that I would say is I was just thinking about this last night, actually, in terms of, you know, sometimes as working in the arts, you kind of wonder if your job has any value. I wonder about that sometimes, like if I would be better off, working for a nonprofit or something that was directly doing something objectively good for the world. And working in Hollywood and working in entertainment and other arts, I think it's hard to really identify what you're doing is worthwhile. And that's one thing that's been great about Teen Wolf, is that value to what we do personally is demonstrated by the fans and the fandom. I mean, that's like, we get to see that, you know, we are doing something worthwhile because other people think it's worthwhile. And the fact that people are so enthusiastic about it is so just humbling you know, and gratifying, and makes our careers feel like it's worth it, you know? So I don't know. I'm just really appreciative, to be part of something that, people value so much.
Yeah. And it seems like such a great fandom, and there's so much enthusiasm. I mean, hopefully positive. I know there's enthusiasm on all
any
levels,
enthusiasm
but,
is appreciated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's Gabe and I were it was Gabe's idea, but you know, Gabe and I did the fan art gallery, and that was it wasn't actually meant to like show our appreciation, although seems to be what has happened, but it was really because we just really loved seeing this stuff.
And that's what I was kind of realizing last night, is the reason we put those pictures up is it was like, you can point at them and be like, see, what we're doing has worth.
Yeah.
You know, it's like looking at that it has meaning, all of our work here. It's like, look, somebody cared that much.
Yeah.
What we're doing is worthwhile.
Exactly.
Which is, it's, I mean, it maybe sounds surprising from the outside, but, you know, you don't get that a lot in entertainment. There's a lot of jobs are kind of, you know.
And I think, you know, we all hear about all these wonderful things that are happening around the world. People are, learning how to purify water and all these wonderful jobs that are really contributing something great. And so I understand what Gabe is saying in that, you know, sometimes you do have to take a step back and be like, oh, this is my job. Is that worth it to entertain? But you always need entertainment, I guess.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Yeah. Look, somebody made this piece. Of course it's worth it. Yeah. They were moved.
Exactly.
That's the whole point.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I can understand where you guys are coming from with that. And one of the jokes in the fandom that people always say is it was supposed to be a dumb show about teenage werewolves, and it turned out to be so much more. And obviously we made an entire podcast about it. We've done 76 episodes about it. So we care a lot, and it really affected us. And I think that, you know, if you think about it as just a television show and just entertainment, I can completely understand why you would be like, you know, is this worth it? Could I be doing something more productive with my time? But like you said, everybody needs entertainment. And I think that the themes that come through in the show are really deep and moving, and that's always worth it. And one of my favorite things is the give and take between the show and the people who work on the show and the fans. And that's, you know, definitely a perfect example is that art gallery, because nobody expected to make Teen Wolf art and have it actually in the offices at Teen Wolf. And it happened. And it's a really wonderful thing to see play out.
Yeah.
Well, we're really hoping to actually expand it soon.
Yeah.
Let's see. We're about to go on hiatus in a few weeks, but if and when we come back, we will expand.
Right. We'll expand a little bit.
So.
Yeah. Well, I think that sounds like a fantastic idea. And I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and talking to us. It really means a lot to us, and it was super interesting. So I hope everybody listening to this had a great time and learned a few things.
Cool.
I hope so too. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes, thank you very much.
Thanks for doing the podcast.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Thanks.